I just can't have any social life right now.
Don't worry about it. We're just having coffee. We'll be antisocial.
Welcome, listeners, to another Damn Fine Espresso. Happy New Year, everyone, and Happy New Year to you, Julie.
Happy New Year.
It's good to see you and to hear you. And a while ago, we started talking a little bit about cinema 100 years ago in connection, I think, with our Buster Keaton episode.
Yeah.
And we got talking also about other areas of cinema, especially German cinema at the time, Weimar cinema, as it's sometimes called. And I know you have a special fascination about that period as well, and so do I. So we decided to talk about this in our espresso episode. So Julie, what is it that fascinates you so much about the German cinema of the mid-20s, late-20s, and so on?
Well, after the First World War, Germany was in dire straits, obviously. There was a very long period of hyperinflation and economic dire straits. But then there was this period from about 24, 25 until the economic crisis hit in 29. And then afterwards, Germany was taken over by the Nazis. This short period was a period of enormous cultural development and bloom. The most incredible stuff was made during the period. We have writers, we have film, we have theater, we have plays. And for this short period of time, stuff was allowed that wouldn't be allowed again for, I don't know, decades, right? So this brief blink of an eye in history really gave us the most fascinating, innovative stuff in film too. And it always draws me to it because it feels so modern and it feels like really something special, something new, something, you know, very much of its own. You can't compare it to anything. And then, that development was shut down brutally by first an enormous economic crisis and then the Reichstag fire and Hitler being made chancellor and what all that led to. And all that disappeared again for decades. And we've now almost forgotten about it. And I still have a place in my heart for that period in culture.
And I think that's now a chance for us 100 years later also to be reminded of these seminal things happening and these double catastrophes happening. I think that's what it is to me, right? We had such a bloom around the turn of the century and then World War I happens and destroys all that. And then comes that period that you mentioned with especially Germany after all these dire straits seeming to have a cultural revival, so many things happening. And then comes the second catastrophe with the rise of Hitler and obviously with the Second World War breaking out. So I was always fascinated also by the lines that are going through that time of people's lives, of people's careers, mm-hmm. of how they are broken up either by 1914, 1918, and then often end in emigration. But then the Weimar period, again, producing so many fresh talents, directors, stars, movie production personnel that then also needs to kind of make decisions, right? Once Hitler comes to power, where do we go? Do we stay? Are we allowed to stay? Do we have a Jewish background and suddenly are forced into exile or into a completely different path? And then what do you do? Are you producing movies for the new regime? Are you leaving for France or for the US? And I think that was always of great fascination to me. So that's what got us talking. And I think also what got us talking was one particular director, Georg Friedrich Pabst, who is one of the most prolific directors of Weimar cinema. He's called at the beginning the Red Pabst because he was seen as kind of a socialist, communist style director or theme director. And his early films were criticized by conservative viewers and politicians. But then his life is interesting. And there is that book by Daniel Kehlmann, Lichtspiel, that I've recently read. And I think we talked about that as well. He wrote a biography, or not a biography, but he wrote the life of Pabst into a novel.
Yeah, it's called a novel, traces, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's very particularly written also in terms of perspectives. And of course, it traces Pabst's decision to leave at first to go to France to try his luck in Hollywood. But then his story leads him back to Nazi Germany in the end. But maybe we can talk about that a little later because you have watched a Pabst film recently in preparation, and I'm very curious to see what do you think of his cinema from that Weimar period.
Well, I saw, for starters, the film is called Pandora's Box, and it has Louise Brooks, right? She's an American star. She plays the lead, so not a German star. If you look closely, you can also see her speak English if you lip read her, which is also interesting. And what you see with Pabst's style, he has a very fluid directorial style. It almost feels very modern. It's not static in that sense. The film is an adaptation of a play that probably none of our listeners remember, which is about a character named Lulu. And it was written by Frank Wedekind, who was a satirist. And it's sort of about this young girl who grows up here, there and everywhere and in foster homes and then goes to a circus and then goes to prison and then becomes the mistress to this bourgeois, rich gentleman. But his bourgeois sensibilities can't bear to have a flapper mistress like Lulu, and all sorts of drama ensues. And of course, she ends up with a flotsam and jetsam in the gutter and so on and so forth. So do put your melodrama hat on. It's meant, I think, but I'm not, you know, like Matt, a literary specialist, but I think it's a sort of indictment of the bourgeoisie in that everybody knows that it's hypocritical, but nobody will, you know, own up to the fact that society is just hypocritical in that way. Is that people have mistresses, but you don't talk about it. And as long as that don't give any trouble, right, you don't have to sort of deal with it. But it's a smashing film, also visually, a very smashing film. Of course, this will give you a very good idea why Louise Brooks was as major a star as she became, because she is incredible in this. And the story is almost hardly sort of the point. It's a really character sort of driven piece. So don't worry about the melodrama listeners. You can see it anyway. And some of the characters, I mean, we have Lulu's friends, Alva, which is a male friend. And there is the Countess Augusta Geschwitz, who is obviously very much in love with Lulu, but it's not, well, not as far as we know, reciprocated, because Lulu goes with a doctor who is rich, but then wants to go get married and get rid of Lulu. And then Alva falls for her and the doctor throws Alva out and so on and so forth, right? Really, really nice and sort of overwrought. But these characters, they're pretty believable. And I don't know if I've ever seen somebody who is in love with a woman who is in love with a woman so casually. She's just there, right? And her place in the plot is to try and help Lulu out and not to be a love interest. And I don't think we see that again for, like, I don't know, years and years and years and years and
decades years. and decades. Yeah, I was thinking.
So it's so interesting. And this is a film from 1929. And it also deals with, for instance, a Lulu falls into sex work, which you don't see the censors approving of after 1933 in America. And also addiction, alcohol addiction and gambling addiction, which you also don't see the censors approving of after 1933, right? So on the one hand, it's possible to say this is very European. This is very of its time and place. This is this one moment in time, this blink of an eye in Germany where this was possible. And after that, it was simply no longer possible. And even the films that were made then in Europe were usually recut by censors in the United States, right? So they didn't go into cinema there as they would in Germany. Nosferatu is a good case in point. And on the other hand, I mean, you look at it and you're like, why did these types of characters disappear from the screen for so long? It's so weird. Mm-hmm. So many powers trying to sort of wipe them out of existence. I think it's really worth seeing. It's a very good film. It's very well done, very well directed. It's acted as a silent film usually is, which is to say it looks rather theatrical, but it's supposed to. I don't think that's a detract from it in any way. And it's like, where did all these characters go? Where did all these ideas go? I mean, the people didn't just disappear because Hitler was Reichskanzler. They had these ideas were still there and these people were still there. So I thought it was a really fascinating film, and it's really extraordinary to look at. I think you should be able to find it if you look. I mean, and Sam, you too, just go see it. I mean, it's fantastic.
I will, because, you know, I came across so many of the titles on his filmography, especially the ones that he made before he emigrated the first time. And of course, Pandora's Box ranks very highly because his discovery or so-called discovery of Louise Brooks and how he made her into a star in two of his films as an American in German cinema, that is, of course, one of the key elements also of the novel. But it seems to be also a film that, in a nutshell, somehow tells us what Weimar cinema is all about. You know, the social critique on the conservative system, the daring subject matter that was able to be put on the screen, the flapper girl who seems to be at the center of this. So in very many ways, that seems to be a very essential of Weimar cinema. Would you say it's one of the more typical films of that era that you have seen?
In atmosphere, certainly. I mean, don't forget that Hitchcock grew up in a way in Weimar cinema, right? So it has this atmosphere, this very pervasive atmosphere that in that sense, it's very Weimar. It has, of course, the characters, what I would call transgressive, but maybe it wasn't really that transgressive at the time. And this sort of party, because tomorrow we die atmosphere, right? Take every day as it's given because, you know, life basically will cut you down soon enough. But I also think it's a bit retroactive because some of the other Weimar films, or between quotes, Weimar-esque films, are not as, how do you call that, experimental, right? They're comedies and they're romances and so on. So to call Pandora's Box typical would sort of be like saying, well, Psycho is a typical thriller of the time. No, it's not. It's an extraordinary thriller of the time,
right,
which is what makes it famous and which is what makes it memorable. And the same it goes for Pandora's Box, I think. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary movie.
Right. I think I came across one documentary that I thought was really triggered that interest for me, which was by Rüdiger Süßland. It was called From Cagliari to Hitler, which kind of traces the Weimar period of cinema and shows so many examples. And I think for me, at that time when I saw it in 2014, so roughly 10 years ago, I think it was the first time for me to see so many excerpts from so many different movies that trace this development throughout the 20s and then up until the early 1930s. What I find fascinating is then what happens with Pops. It's an unusual story. It's not the usual emigration story that you have with so many representatives of German cinema of the 20s. We talked about Fritz Lang just a little bit before, who goes to Hollywood and who successfully makes films there as well. He finds a new identity or a new second life in cinema. And Pops isn't one of those. One of the novel's chapters shows him very unhappy in the Californian sun with the offers that he gets.
I remember that.
He thinks,
that
you
bit.
Know, I made those movies, so why aren't they offering me better material? But then he hopes that later on they will, but nothing ever comes off it. So he makes the fateful decision of first going back to France and trying to make a movie there, but that falls through. And then because of the health of his mother, he needs to go back to Austria, where he grew up. Of course, Anschluss Austria, soon after the war breaks out and he's no longer able to leave. And shortly after, they start knocking on his door from, you know, people he met in Hollywood that he sensed were Nazis trying to lure him back. And they are at his door now. And they say, you know, there's the Reichspropaganda minister is waiting for you in Berlin. You can always go there and have fantastic productions and lots of money will be thrown at you if you just make movies for us. And it's about that conflict that Pops goes through. So that's always something that I found extremely fascinating. I mean, the immigration story is on the one hand, how do you find a second life possibly in other European countries or in Hollywood? And how does that influence Hollywood's own filmmaking then? But then for the ones that stayed behind, or in the extreme case like him, went back, how do we look at them afterwards? How do we look differently at Pandora's Box and his Weimar films, knowing that? I don't know, does that concern you sometimes when you hear stories like that?
Well, I think if we talk about the period, we tend to forget too much that these were all people that were squashed between two worlds. I mean, these are not linear stories. It's not like, okay, I get a dictator in power in my country. I flee to Belgium and get to wash my hands in innocence for the rest of my life. I mean, it's always a dilemma. There are more than one writer who stayed in Germany because their parents were old and sick. They couldn't leave them. There are stories of people who returned willingly or unwillingly. There are people like Lang, who, according to him, his partner was much more enamored with the Nazi cause than he was, and he had to leave in the middle of the night because he had heard that Goebbels and his men were going to ask him to make films for them, and he fled to America. There's a very funny part in the book that you mentioned in which the American producers keep praising him for making Metropolis, which of course he never did. That's another German movie by another German director, which just goes to show that they look very differently at these émigrés, right, than they thought about themselves. But I think it's always complicated. It's never easy. And I think Pabst had to live with the consequences of what was basically an impossible situation. But what you do see in Lulu and the material that he chose, which was Wedekind of all people, is that he very obviously had a socialist streak. And I don't think that changes when we look at what he did afterwards. I think he was just a man trying to stay afloat. And I'm not excusing that. But I don't think it says anything about his earlier work, which he could make in Comparative Freedom, which may be more representative of what he actually thought of the bourgeois bastards that he was now forced to make, you know, mealy-mouthed films for, which again is ironic because he was very up in arms against the American producers because they all wanted to flatten his films and they all wanted to romanticize and they all wanted to make it all simple and Hollywoody and stupid. But when he got back to Austria, that was exactly what he was forced to do. And now he didn't have a choice. Now he could no longer say, sorry, Mr. Minister, but stuff it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that would probably cost not only him his life, but also his loved ones. So there's a lot of, I don't want to call it irony because that sounds like it's somehow funny, but there's a lot of tragedy in there in that he made choices that got him from bad to worse and from the frying pan into the fire because of who he was and because he was a hard-headed and because he had a vision and he wouldn't compromise, and that made him compromise even more and more and more and more.
Mm-hmm.
So I think these earlier pieces are maybe almost redemptive in that we see how he started and what his trajectory might have been. As a filmmaker, not as a person, but as a filmmaker, in better circumstances.
And I think that's the conflict really that the book shows so well, because he has that artistic vision and he doesn't want to compromise. That's why he leaves the US, obviously, and feels France is going to be the place for him. But then, of course, in Germany, he is given, at least on the surface, a lot of freedom. But of course, he's asked to serve the Nazi film industry, which is, we often forget, was one of the most productive periods in history concerning films. I think about 1,000 films were made in those
enormous
few
amounts.
Years. And there's the other part of the documentary by Süsland that is called Hitler's Hollywood, which I actually saw first. And of course, this is a very eerie watch because you get to see excerpts from films, mostly, that you can't watch, or that they're not really available, or that they're hardly ever shown. And of course, it makes you aware of what a productive period that was to put out as much material for the masses, but then also, of course, present as much material from the Nazi point of view, or at least
pure propaganda
made under these production circumstances. And so Pabst becomes one of those people. He makes 3 major films during that period. The most famous one is probably Paracelsus, biography about the historical figure. And the book also talks how he tried to make this into an artistically pleasing film for him. You know, he was very proud of certain things and certain scenes. One in particular is described in the book. But then, of course, he also had to compromise at the end of the war with a production where he supposedly engaged, or had to engage, because they lacked extras. They were getting people from camps, prisoners of war, that they dressed up. And there's a horrific scene where they are supposed to sit in a concert and they were missing people for that scene. And they got them in, they dressed them up, you know, they cleaned them up for that day shoot. And yeah, they shot that scene with all those people sitting with straight faces because they weren't allowed, of course, to do anything else. for that scene. So I think it the book puts some of these key questions about those filmmakers who stayed behind and who did compromise, and of course puts people like Pops on the spot as well and says, well, how far were you prepared to go to fulfill your artistic vision, to be that successful filmmaker and not to have your art compromised? But then this happens, and right. You have to do that under emergency circumstances.
Well, we have to be very precise here, because part of our story today is about a novel. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, the writer, his name was Kilman, right?
Exactly, Daniel Kilman.
He's a wonderful writer, very evocative, but we don't know if that is exactly historically accurate.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, and the fact that generally we know what factually happened, we just don't know how someone like Pops might have felt about it or how much he might have known. But like Mr. Kilman, I find it very, very hard to believe that Mr. Pops did not know.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And that puts him in a quandary, because do you then decide to not know and to look away? So it's a very hard, hard, hard story to think about, but we do have to be accurate. Part of this is a novelization. So we don't know what was in that man's heart. We know that when he got old, he got dementia. So we couldn't ask him anything anymore. He went into an institution, I think, right, Sam?
Mm-hmm.
He was admitted.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a lot of stuff we don't know firsthand, but Mr. Kilman makes a very, very sort of convincing point.
Yeah, and I think he puts together so many different life stories as well that cross Pops' path.
Mm.
And I think that's interesting too, how he meets a couple of the film stars that were famous during the Nazi period. And then, of course, they stayed famous in the 1950s and beyond. And the same for filmmakers. Leni Riefenstahl is probably the most famous example here that shows up repeatedly. And I think the episode about the prisoners of war might also be based on, of course, the accusations that were made against Tiefland by Riefenstahl, where she also used people involved in the war and prisoners for those for some of her scenes. And Pops is a part of that filming, or was a part of that filming as well.
Of course, it's a very compelling argument. I mean, I find it completely believable that something of the sort absolutely happened.
And I think he makes those situations very believable for the reader also to put themselves into that decision making and into, you know, those puzzle pieces that he pulls together to say, okay, this was the role that filmmakers had. So do we judge them? Do we see them differently? Did they have a choice? I think it's a very compelling book because of that, because you're not quite sure how to feel about this, right?
I'm not sure how to feel about this. I'm both heartbroken, shocked, and nauseated about it. I'm furious. But just tangentially, outside of the book, when you look at Pops and at his movies, I mean, how much are your principles worth when you find yourself in that sort of situation? I mean, I think we can safely say that Pops was very left-wing when he started making films, maybe even socialist, right? Like Brecht was. And then what is that worth now that you're an employee of the Nazi propaganda machine? How do you deal with this? Aren't these highfalutin principles very fragile,
mm-hmm.
you know, to begin with? Because I don't think I put this in the first part about the Weimar Republic. Socialism was huge in that time. We tend to think of it as Nazis as very right-wing and very conservative, but socialism, even communism, was a huge movement. Everybody was scared to death of those political movements. So it was a big ideology, more so, I think, than it is now. And people tend to forget that was a big thing.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of very influential socialists and communists, right? And you could even say, I think without being inaccurate, that this is one of the reasons that the National Socialism began to gain popularity, because it was an anti-communist ideology, right? And Pabst, I think, is so indicative because, not to look into this man's brain, but because he is part of that wave. He starts as a sort of socialist, anti-bourgeois person, and he falls into this propagandist, purely conservative machine. And he was proud of it too.
Yeah, and how often then fascism was seen as the conservatives' remedy against communism, right? So the smaller ill and somehow being able to control it later on, if only we can get rid of the communists. So I think it's a very interesting dynamic that not just filmmakers, but everybody found themselves in that period. I mean, to wrap up what happened to Pops, I think the final then big switch comes in 45, right? Which is the other fascinating thing that I guess we could also talk at length about, is that what happens to people like him who did compromise and who did make films during that period, what happens to him after 45? And I think Pops is fascinating example because he again is a third career with rather run-of-the-mill courtroom drama and even a couple of anti-Nazi films that he makes.
Of course.
He even gets there's a prize in Venice for one of them in the late 1940s. So it's so interesting to see him go on that.
Well, he should know, right? I mean, he was in a way part of it.
Yeah, but how that continues. And I think it'd be interesting to draw the lines with so many biographies of people who stayed, but also maybe came back after 45, and what kind of cinema comes out, what kind of post-war cinema comes out in Germany. I remember seeing a lot of the 1950s Heimatfilme when I was a child.
Yes, you know, this, I know.
This hyper kitschy period of, you know, everyone's just in the countryside and everyone's just a hunter and everyone's just like wearing dirndl and
these pastoral scenes of when it was pure and right. Oh, good Lord.
So much denial and so much sticking your head in the sand in cinematic terms. And of course, people's needs to see something else than their war-ruined countries. But yeah, Pops had another role to play in that. And I think the book just made me think again of how interesting it would be to go into more such stories and see where did people land that had that big career in Weimar and what happened during the 1930s and what did they do in post-World War II.
But also the others, right? Think of Marlene Dietrich.
Right.
Who left and became a really big deal as an enormous star. By the way, Marlene Dietrich, if you want to have a sense of the time, look up the video where she sings Where Have All the Flowers Gone, right? The pain, it still communicates, right? Even now. But people like that, I mean, our listeners may not have consciously heard of Pops before, but you certainly remember Dietrich, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you remember Carol Reese, the third man. These are stories that used to really inhabit people. And we sort of turned away from them and onward to a better future. And we've almost forgotten them. And as you say, that the I won't call them Nazi films, but the films that were made under the supervision of the Ministry of Propaganda during the Nazi era. Is that polite enough, do you think?
Indeed. Very well put.
Some of them are just no longer there. We can't compare them with anything because we can't find them. And I think in a way that also blinds us to a regime who tried to take its people from the inside out, really inhabit them, really take them heart and soul and mind, like they did with Pops, because it was proud of his films, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Riefenstahl.
And it's interesting that his film, you know, his last film that he makes in 45 is one of those lost films. So we don't quite know how this would have played out as one of his, you know, masterpieces or whatever that film would have become. Hard to say, but I think it's interesting that the story in a way revolves around also a lost film that may be representative of so many.
Do you know, has that book been translated? I read part of it in German.
I assume not yet, because it only came out in late October last year.
Last year, yeah.
So I assume it will be translated, because I think other books of his, Die Vermessung der Welt, was a huge hit internationally. So I assume there will be, if there not already are, I haven't checked, and there will be copies. So I do recommend it to our listeners, not just for, you know, people interested in German cinema of the time, but I think also just generally as a maybe a parable or a lifelines of someone going through so many radical changes in
right.
in their career and how they make decisions and so on. It's yeah. very representative of that, I find.
And as you say, we tend to close our eyes for anything but the pure black and white of the people who got away and became anti-Nazi and the people who were on the other side. And you get to Schindler's List. And we forget all the stories in between of people who basically may have thought that they had no choice or may have had other things or may not have taken it that seriously and became entrapped. And again, I am not endorsing what Pabst did, but it's a complicated human story in a complicated world in which, as we said at the beginning, first you have the First World War, then you have a pandemic, then you have a major economic crisis with inflation so bad that you needed a skip to give your money to the baker for one bread. Then finally stuff settles down, and then you get another major economic crisis, and then you get Nazis. This is a lot to go through in a lifetime.
And I think maybe that 100th anniversary of those years in the next few years will also give us a chance to put ourselves into the minds and shoes of people who lived through that dramatic period and see. So thank you, Julie, for taking the time to talk about a difficult subject, but such an interesting, worthwhile one.
Very.
And I think where I feel we're only scratching the surface, right? So
right.
I'll be looking forward to see what comes off of that.
Maybe something from the period that's a little bit more cheerful.
Why not?
Why not? Something like a musical comedy.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Do you have one that you would recommend at this point?
I do, but I will keep it a secret because we may want to do it at some other time.
Let's do it. Let's do it. I'm very curious about that. So anyway, listeners, hopefully that gave you an interesting insight into one of our many cinematic interests at the beginning of this year as we look back. And of course, we'll look at many more movie-related subjects. So thanks, Julie, again.
Thank you, Sam.
And thanks to our listeners. And join us next time for a damn fine espresso. Bye-bye.
Bye.